Welcome to the new IT. Welcome to the new IT. Here we are in the house. Brad, what's going on in the crazy world of the new IT and all of the craziness? What's going on?
Oh, there's lots of crazy going on. But I will have to say, though, I mean, the last few shows we've done, I'm really just digging this whole festive Bobby. I don't know what it is, but it's just Bobby. It's enlightening. It's fun. It's upbeat. I like it.
Some of my other podcasts are wearing off on me. I'm sorry.
That's a good thing. No, I like it. I like how it's blended in.
I get way into the introduction. It's too much fun.
Yeah. I mean, roll with it. Let's do it.
So what's happening today, man? Who's in the house?
I'm loving today's show. So we actually have Mike Gifford on the show, and he's with Civic Actions. So I'm gonna give it over to Mike and let him do an intro, and maybe he can tell us a little about himself and Civic Actions.
Let's do it. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Brad and Bobby. I'm Mike Gifford. I'm up in Ottawa, Canada. I'm a senior strategist here at Civic Actions. Before that, for 21 years, I ran my own business, one called Open Concept. Both at Open Concept and also with Civic Actions, we do a lot of work with Drupal. Drupal's a content management system that's been around for a while, but really is still a real innovator in the tech space. And I'm with the Drupal community. I'm a Drupal accessibility maintainer. And as part of that, trying to go off and make sure that the best practices of Drupal best practices of accessibility are wrapped into the way that we build Drupal software. So that's a quick intro of me. Civic Actions is a company that's been around, I guess, for 16 years, I think. We exist in both Canada and the United States, and we've got entities in both places and work for both governments and whatnot and nonprofits in both places. Civic Actions is a company that is very much works on open source and Drupal as well, but also has a large human-centered design practice. So HCD and customer experience is a big part of what we do and what we deliver for our clients, and an important part of what we think building a modern digital web interface should include. So
awesome.
I gotta ask, Mike, most folks that are in the open source space kind of has a story around it, and I'm just curious, what got you in that? I mean, I'm sure you did other things, and why were you in the open source world? I usually there's a story behind that.
It's a good question. Back when I started being involved in the web, the person who was really mentoring me on web development back in the
early 2000s, maybe?
No, this is much earlier than that. Okay. This is probably 98, 99.
Okay.
He was a big open source advocate and still is a big open source advocate. So he definitely introduced me to people and concepts, and was able to go off into with friends of mine, get to have some familiarity with the Linux kernel and work that's been how open source is developed within the Linux kernel, let alone in a whole variety of other projects. So not that I have that level of knowledge to actually be a kernel developer, but we certainly have over many decades sort of seen the evolution of this software, and it's because of friends who helped me out and helped me get into this industry back 98, 99. So
yeah. 25 years ago.
I love it. 98, same here. I remember I had gotten my MCSE and Microsoft certifications, right, and stuff like that. But I remember Red Hat, dude. I was so excited. I got me a Red Hat and Linux, yeah, and I was installing it. I was like, dude, this is free. This is so freaking cool. This is awesome. And I get it all installed, and then there's this flashing cursor, blinking cursor. I'm like, okay. Okay, that's cool. That's cool now. Exactly now.
What am I going to put in now?
The Linux distributions getting sent out in various different, like there was Mandrake and SUSE, well before Debian came around, and now we've got sort of Ubuntu and so many different flavors of Linux. It's wonderful to see
Puppy Linux. You remember Puppy is a little, it's like on a you could run it on a floppy disk.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
That's before my time.
Do you remember Puppy Linux?
I don't remember Puppy Linux.
it was like literally on a floppy disk. You could run the whole OS.
Wow.
But anyway,
simple times.
And now you look at how many systems are. Like how many different systems are running off of very small processors, right? And as we're moving towards edge processing, the number of times we want to actually manage computation on something that's no bigger than an Arduino, right? Like those are the Raspberry Pis, Arduinos. Those are really small processors,
yeah.
And yet they're so powerful. And you need to have a kernel that's set up to manage those. And you know,
there's so much we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask this question, and I know it's kind of on topic, but kind of off topic. What do you say to the people that are saying that Drupal's dead, Drupal's not alive, there's so many other CMS platforms out there, why should we go with Drupal? I mean, what do you say to those people, and what is the common theme of why you should go with Drupal?
I mean, it really depends on what your use case is. If you've got a bunch of tech savvy people and you want to build something with Markdown, like, and if they've got people comfortable implementing changes with Git, like by all means, go ahead. You're going to have, you know, GitHub Pages is totally powerful. The stuff you can do with 11t and Jekyll and like so many other, there's so many other CMSs out there. But really, what sets Drupal apart from all the others is that it's built for authors, like to have something in place that allows for non-technical people to collaboratively work on creating content and managing content together. That's definitely something that's different than most of the other new CMSs that are coming out. But also, there's a stable professional class of organizations and developers that are behind that. You don't see that in a lot of other systems. There might be places where you might, in certain regional areas, have a bunch of people who know Typo3 or know Plone, but there's just a bigger critical mass of developers who are working with and improving the Drupal community than there are in most other content management systems. Now, the WordPress community is different, but they've, because they've got a fractured environment, because they have, you know, the core project, which is open source, and then so much of the contributed software is proprietary.
Yeah. Exactly.
You've got this, it's a fractured community. You don't have the space where everyone's working and rowing in the same direction. Where with Drupal, everything on Drupal.org is under the GPL, and there's a consistency which gives more greater reliability and greater community around that. Not that is dissing WordPress. I mean, WordPress was an interesting approach to using open source, and they certainly have been successful in terms of building a platform that is serving a real need in our community. But there's still like so many amazing ways that you can build build content engines now with so many other tools. And now that we're looking at distributed implementations, whether it's looking at stuff that's using Solid or using efforts like the federated sites and federated infrastructure, there's so much that we could be looking at, but that hasn't really sort of cemented in place yet. It's still very much up in the air in terms of where the industry, what will happen beyond sort of those centralized servers.
I gotcha. That makes sense. So yeah, I mean, I think I still think the CMS platform systems is a very interesting area to cover. I mean, that's in terms of recruitment, that's my bread and butter, but
right.
I think there's so much out there that it's interesting to see where it's going. I mean, I think a lot of them are very similar but very different in the same way they do things.
With and that, it's having that community of people is just so
exactly.
rare.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. Yep. With that said, we like to always ask this question. How would you say that the company is a disruptor in the industry itself? Are you just a standard, or are you a disruptor? Do you feel like your technology and stuff that you guys are doing is kind of over and above what's happening out there?
I think that we are a disruptor in a few places, both in terms of looking. We focus largely on government. So what is it that we can implement in the
it
government
space? It needs some
space?
Disruption.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah. So but also we very much believe in open source. There's a lot of Drupal agencies that are there and they use the software, but they don't contribute back to it. And Civic Actions has had a long-standing relationship with the Drupal community and contributes back on a lot of different projects, and has a solid understanding of the value of open source as a platform, but also as an ethic. And it's one of our core values with Civic Actions. It's balance and caring and openness are the three sort of core values that we have for our team.
So you're really a part of the community and not just using it. You're
absolutely
you're
that's
really
awesome.
A part of the community.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have a little bit of sway in the direction of how it's going. I mean, do you feel like that you guys kind of have, you know, not necessarily, hey, let's go this way, but do you know what I mean? You have a little more say than those folks that are just out there kind of using it and doing whatever.
And because we've been involved for so long, and because, you know, I mean, I can, I'm not the only one in Civic Actions who knows, you know, a lot of people in the Drupal community, and who's been present and talking and leading presentations at DrupalCon and other Drupal events. I think that being a Drupal core maintainer is something that does definitely help to try and shift things around accessibility and to help direct that. But there's certainly other roles as well around that Civic Actions is trying to play a part in, and particularly in terms of how open source is adopted in government, and what can we do to try and build better practices of adopting open source tools and technology in government so that it can help the community flourish.
So how awesome. That is cool. How would you say are you innovative? What are you guys, are you pushing the envelope on anything? Are you being, you know, out of the box thinking, that kind of stuff? I mean, when we're talking open source, you're already there, of course.
Yeah,
but
right.
Is there anything that you can say for your company that is innovative?
I think that there are things that we're working on to try and embed accessibility into how we're working that are different. So, you know, some of our big clients are like CMS.gov and Medicare.gov are two of our larger clients.
Those are fairly big.
Theirs are fairly
just
big.
A little bit.
Veterans Affairs is one of our other ones.
Awesome. Oh, really?
National Science Federation. Like, we've got some big clients, and all of them need to meet Section 508 requirements. But trying to go off and take those accessibility requirements and take them from being a long checklist and say, well, let's actually divide that up. How do we try and structure it so that our teams actually know what parts they're responsible for? How do we make sure that the designers know what of that they're responsible for? What do we know of the front-end developers? What are they responsible for? What about the DevOps people? How are they involved? What about the project management team? How do we work together as a team to try and address this and not sort of see accessibility as the responsibility of one person on the team, but it's really something that takes a collaborative effort. It's really not much different from security, and security has been at this for longer, but it just takes one person in the development, in the software development process, to be really lax about their security, and suddenly, you know, the whole team is, it's all compromised.
You're as strong as your weakest link.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah, and it's very much the same with accessibility. So we're working on trying to innovate in that space and to share best practices and to really be guiding our clients as much as we can in trying to adopt new innovative approaches, and also contributing back to the community and finding ways that we can find ways to do that. Like we were trying to go off and lead Drupal in adopting the GAD pledge. There's this big accessibility event that happens every year called Global Accessibility Awareness Day. And one of the events that we do as part of that is this, there's a GAD pledge that the GAD Foundation puts out. And Drupal was awarded that, awarded the GAD pledge this year for 2022. And as part of that, there's a bunch of stuff we needed to do, one of which was to create an accessibility standards or coding standards so that we can say, For developers and designers, when you're coming to go off and implement Drupal code, when you're contributing back to the Drupal community, what are the standards we expect you to meet? What are the things we expect you to do? And so that's something that I've been working on in the last little while to try and bring out so that there's more clarity in this, that there isn't as much guesswork, but also to try and expose all the stuff that we've done in Drupal over the years that isn't necessarily apparent to everyone, because, you know, the core team knows about it because we were involved in the issue queue trying to push these issues ahead. But there's a lot of people who are just, you know, site builders or module builders or, you know, module maintainers that don't necessarily know the stuff that we've built into core to try and make it easier for people to roll out going ahead.
Got it. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if this is a question, how you can answer this, but with Drupal being open source, I mean, what do you say to the people that say that it's less secure or it's not as secure as something that's more closed?
Well, I would say that's nonsense, and I would say that the U.S. military is definitely going to back me up on this, because they've definitely been advocating for the use of open source, and see that there's a lot of security advantages to open source. It just comes down to how many eyes are looking at the project. You know, if you've got a proprietary tool, like, I can't necessarily know how many people are working on this, and if you're looking at initiatives like the Linux Foundation's Core Infrastructure Initiative is a really great way to try and say, well, how do we try and assess the weakest link? How do we try and make sure that those modules that are key to the internet are not overlooked as part of that? How do we try and harden those core elements that we all depend on to make sure that security is built right into the code base? And so having that mentality that we need to go off and be thinking about and looking at and watching these software packages is really key. But if you're in a proprietary system, like, who really knows? Like, if Bob built that widget 2 years ago and his contract ran out and he's no longer with the company because he's gone off to Google, like, you know,
who knows?
Like, who's maintaining that software, right?
But exactly. At least in a scramble to figure it out,
right?
Yeah. But with open source, you can see the code, you can evaluate it, you know who the contributors are, there's transparency, and it's something that keeps everyone honest, because everyone can see what's in the commit logs. Not that everyone's looking at it, but you can.
You have exactly. You have the power to look at it, even though you're not.
And there's a lot of folks that could just jump in and hit the ground running.
Exactly. Just pick up where you left off and go from there.
Yeah, and again, you can, just even in terms of testing and evaluating the software, with a lot of proprietary tools, you can't actually even install your own version of it to get a fully running licensed copy of it until you've run through a whole bunch of legal paperwork in order to go off and to clear it through procurement. But at that point, I mean, is that the time to be evaluating and testing it? And do you need to, like, if most software these days has at least multiple releases a year, if not multiple releases a day.
Right.
So how are you going to go off and make sure that this proprietary software is actually being kept up to date with those latest security changes it doesn't really matter if your security team reviewed this proprietary tool 2 years ago, if you're no longer using if you're 1,000 releases, you know, ahead of where the security team reviewed it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I get you. That makes sense. So I know we kind of talked about this a little bit already, but help me understand who takes care of your technology and tell me a little bit more about Civic Actions and how big the team is and things of that nature.
So I think we're about 120 people at this point. And as I said, we've got, we're a bit engineer heavy, but we have a solid HCD team that is working to go off and make sure that we're able to present strong customer experiences to our clients. But we've got DevOps people, and we've got, engineers and site builders and front-end engineers. And there's we work in various different practice areas. So there's a Drupal practice area, there's an engineering practice area, there's a practice area for front-end engineers and designers, and so we sort of divide up the different sort of sections of web development into practice areas that have their own cultures and work together to try and improve the practices of our various different teams, trying to share information between our clients. What are the things that we can learn from one client that we can then share with the other? And again, not in terms of there's a lot of stuff you can't share with confidential information, databases and whatnot. But there's a lot of stuff that's like, if it's an open source project and you're implementing a tool like editorially, like, there's a lot that can be learned about how to implement this particular module in a way that is going to be more satisfactory to the users in one project versus the other. So how do we try and learn from each other and share best practices, especially because when you're maintaining sites, you have to deal with live authors, live users, live data. Like a lot of stuff is more complicated, but there's ways that we can share our best practices across our practice areas and learn from each other and learn from both the successes and failures that are inevitable in any tech project.
Okay, I gotcha. So tell me, I mean, I know we kind of talked about like a little bit of the tech stack, but tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, what do you look for in a candidate that wants to come work there? I mean, what sort of skill sets does somebody need to have?
We have a sort of a multi-layered interview process that we try and, first of all, determine how well you're going to fit into the company. Is the culture that your organization have, is what you're going to bring, be something that is going to be a positive attitude that will help the broader company, and if you understand our values and if there's alignment around those values. So that's part of the process. Okay. Is trying to make sure that there's a fit. Then we look at depending on what the job is, do you have the basic requirements? And we're an organization that's very conscious of trying to go up and improve the diversity within our own ranks, but also diversity within the industry in general. So we want to try and be able to hire people that wouldn't necessarily get a job in an open source tech company. And frankly, most open source web developers are white guys. So we want to try and do what we can to go off and to make sure that our interview process is open to people who are applying, who have the experience, but may not necessarily have the credentials that we would often expect as part of a traditional computer science or HCD oriented process. So we design our interviews very much to be inclusive of people and to be as accessible as possible, and we're depending on what the position we're looking for. I mean, we could be looking for somebody that has a lot of technical proficiency around something like DevOps. We want to make sure that they understand how to go off to manage Chef or Puppet or other sort of configuration management tools. Or if we want to, if we're looking at for somebody that's building and managing sites, we need to sort of get a sense of like, well, what is their experience with Drupal? Have they contributed to Drupal.org? Do they have a GitHub account? Are they contributing in a way that it's clear that they understand how the open source community works? Can they clearly file an issue queue? Like there's so much that you can determine now based on how people are engaged in the open source community. So if they've got a GitHub profile, if they're forking different projects, if they're active in Stack Overflow, you can start to understand how technical a person is and how well they're able to communicate and work well with others and to work in the open. Because that's something we very well do. Like some of our projects are open to the public. So people need to be able to communicate effectively through an issue queue that may be completely public and will reflect the professionalism of both civic actions as well as the work we're doing for the government.
Awesome. So let's say somebody wants to work or they're looking for a job. There's thousands of jobs out there. Why would they want to work with you? At that company? Why would they want to do that? What do you think is the you kind of hit on culture and stuff. I'm just curious. Yeah. Why would somebody want to work there?
I think there's a few reasons. I mean, one, we're a well-established company. We've been active in the Drupal community for a long time and really have solid roots in that community. We're also very much involved in the civic tech community. So, organizations like Code for America, we've been participating in the Code for America Summit for quite a while. We believe very much in using technology to make government services better for everyone. And again, awesome. That's something there's a lot of people in the government tech space who are there for a number of reasons, but aren't necessarily there to go off and say, how do we try and guide government and guide processes such that citizens get the best result at the end of the day? That we're able to actually provide customer experiences that are good for everyone and that will help other government departments learn. We don't want to go off and we're working in the open and working to collaborate with our partners in government because we definitely see them as partners in this process and see that there's an opportunity to work together to go off and to help shape a more inclusive and effective digital government.
Awesome. So I like it.
Yeah, I do. I think we hit on this a little bit, but I'm curious, what's the process? What's the interview process? I mean, what happens with the candidate? How does that work? Do you get them from a certain... Yeah, you know better than I do.
I'm going to piggyback on that, too, and say... kind of put you on the spot a little bit and say, what do you specifically look for in a candidate? I mean, I know what you kind of said, what Civic Actions does, but when you know you have a good candidate, what is it that says, oh, yeah, that's something they need to have, or that's something I really value?
So Bobby, when you apply for Civic Actions, you've decided like, the heck with this podcasting business. I'm going off to join Civic Actions where the real action happens. The first thing you do is you submit your resume to our, we have our portal, our hiring is managed through Greenhouse. You submit a job, you upload your resume and apply for a job there. And then you'd get, if you meet the criteria, we'd set you up for a work style interview where we'd be able to talk with you to say like, how comfortable are you working remotely? What is your experience working in the distributed team? Do you have any experience working with open source software, sort of learn a bit more about you and sort of get a sense as to how well you'd fit in with our culture and how that our business operates. Also like we discover things like, there's no way you're going to get government security clearance because you've spent too much time in strange countries in Asia or whatever. Like we find out stuff at that point that might be useful to go off and determine if we take the next step. And actually, don't quote me on the time in Asia because I don't actually know if that has any implication.
Understood. We get the example. It was an example. We get.
Yeah. But for me personally, like generally the interviews that I'm part of are tied to accessibility. We've had three interviews for people looking for a senior web accessibility engineer position, and in that we're looking for what is your experience with digital accessibility? Do you have any experience with open source? Do you have any experience with Drupal? Do you have any certifications? There's now a couple of really interesting certifications out there that we encourage people to take. One is the DHS Trusted Tester Program, which is a government-run one. There's also a community-run one that's called the International Association of Accessibility Professionals. There's the CPWA a number of different certifications that are part of that can help determine your level of proficiency with accessibility in that space. And so we look for these issues. We sort of hear how you respond to our questions because after you've gotten the work style interview, we'll if it's determined you're a good fit, we'll have a discussion and run through a number of questions where we evaluate your ability to go off and to do the job. And based on that, if we think you can do you're the best candidate for the job, we'll call your references and make a decision from there.
Wow. Okay. Sounds pretty straightforward. So, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of steps there. I mean, how long does that generally take? I mean, if somebody applies tomorrow, obviously I understand they're not getting a job like the next day or the next week.
Right.
But is it a couple week process or what does that look like?
I mean, generally it's a... I mean, from the beginning to the end, it's probably a month or two, depending on the project and the number of interviews. And it definitely is a long process. But we also believe that it's important to go off and to get the right people. And so much of diversity, if you're looking to hire for diversity, is making sure you're reaching out and making sure you're not just, hitting the usual suspects. You need to try and find people in other spaces other than say LinkedIn or a general posting on your website. There's other organizations that can help reach targeted communities and that's something that we do believe in trying to go off and to reach out to other audiences who may not see this.
That's awesome. I mean, I think that's what definitely sets you guys apart. I mean, understanding and realizing it's not just the same old. You guys are looking for more.
Yeah.
With having said that, I mean, I'm curious, what is your retention rate like? I mean, it sounds like you guys are pretty thorough. So I would think most of the people there are pretty happy. So you're not going to see a lot of that turnover that normal agencies do.
Yeah, I think that we've got historically some quite... some actually very good, our retention rate is really quite good. I think that with COVID, like so many organizations, there was now with the Great Recession, Great Resignation rather, we're not immune to that. I think a lot of people were sort of looking at, what are we doing now? And we also just realized that before the pandemic, Civic Actions was really alone as being one of the few sort of digital agencies that was we didn't have an office. We're a fully distributed team from the beginning.
Awesome.
And And so that did set us apart, you know, before the pandemic. It certainly set us apart, you know, when we were doing this 15 years ago, but because it was much harder back then than it is now.
Right.
But you know, after the pandemic, it was much, much more difficult because now almost everyone is working from home, and there's so many jobs that people are realizing, well, these should be able to be done remotely. And again, we've been leaders in this space as well. One of the members of our team he's not worked with us now. He's actually now working with the government, but for a long time, he was working with us on working to encourage the development of digital teams and to make it easier for digital teams to work effectively together. So the distributed teams book is one of one of the best books about working remotely. And John O'Doon is one of my colleagues that went off and wrote that book. So it's an excellent resource for organizations that are looking to set up good practices for working remotely. And as we all know, it's not just about setting up teams and setting up Office 365. Like, that is not sufficient to create a good digital culture.
Yeah,
no, that makes sense. And I think, you know, I mean, it sounds like you guys are really leading the way with that, and that's amazing. Where can people go to apply, and what sort of jobs are you looking for right now that you maybe want to highlight?
This is a question which I need to go to the website for. I don't actually remember.
Fair enough.
But we have a careers page on the website, and we're almost always looking for.
I thought I saw a Drupal developer on there.
Right now, the only two open positions are for DevOps. DevOps engineers. There's a DevOps data engineer and a DevOps engineer. Those are the only two open positions right now. So I think that the Drupal positions have been filled for the moment, but it is something that you know, we are expanding as a company. And so this list of positions gets updated on a daily basis. And I always need to check, you know, right online to see what what the careers are for the moment.
Great. I think I was looking actually yesterday because I, you know, prepping for the show, and I think I did see like a Drupal developer one on there. So I was like, wow, it's already gone. That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we like to ask the question, you know, this is the new IT. So we like to think about or ask our guests, where do you think your company is going for the future? What do you think is the future for you guys?
Well, I think there's still so much more that can be done with open source, particularly in government. I think we've only really scratched the surface in this area, and there's so much more opportunity now than there ever has been before. There was looking at Drupal and accessibility. I was back in Drupal 8 when Drupal 8 was being developed. I went off and counted basically how many people were contributing to Drupal accessibility issues, and trying to understand, like, are these people that are government people or are government contractors, or are they people who are working, you know, on accessibility issues from other places? And there were basically, there really weren't any government people that were contributing to Drupal core issues back at that time. There are people contributing to modules. There are people from the education sector contributing to core, but there wasn't anyone that I'd seen from government that was working to contribute to core. But just there's an accessibility, a Drupal accessibility meetup or core office hours that I'm involved in because I'm a core maintainer. And that was taking place last month. And there was actually, I think there were three or four people at the meeting who are actively involved in supporting government work and from different companies. And so it's quite interesting to see the growth of government involvement in open source communities. And I think this is going to continue because it's not just with Drupal, but with other open source tools, whether it's things like the there's a whole sort of federalist implementation of GitHub pages. So the U.S. federal government has something called Federalist, which is set up to try and essentially replicate GitHub pages, but for government. So those kinds of open source tools are being implemented and being maintained. And there's people who are starting to understand that power of open source tools within government. And I think that's going to be a real game changer when people who've been advocating for open source to actually understand and participate and start guiding those directions.
That's so interesting, because we think of government as closing, slow, closed up, slow, and not wanting to have anything to do with anything else, a closed system. But you're saying you see the future as the government almost embracing and really connecting with open source and moving that. And I think that's a cool that's a cool thought. And I think you may be right. I don't know.
If you look at globally, I mean, the U.S. actually implements a lot of Drupal. I think 25% of U.S. government websites are run with Drupal.
Wow.
I had no idea.
It's also the same in the European Union. There's more. Wow. I think it's much higher in Australia, because Australia actually has, the Australian government has taken the Drupal content management system and officially said, we're going to be building a platform based on this. So they're doing a lot of interesting stuff with Drupal, and trying to actually push the frontiers of what digital government might look like, including things like legislation as code. How do you try and set up policies so that we're able to actually leverage the power of computers to make decisions around legislative decisions and help citizens actually quickly
be more
and clearly
aware.
Understand.
Make a more decisive decision based off of the facts.
Yeah.
And because
that's
it's open source, people can collaborate on that. And there's another amazing tool called Notify that was built by the UK government that, again, they built this application that sends email and SMS messages to people, and they've released it under an open source license. The Canadian government took that, modified it, added some security issues, continued to work on it. The Australian government has done the same thing, and so is the VA. So there's a bunch of organizations that are government organizations that are taking this open source code and saying, hey, there's an actual need that we can meet in our organization.
Yeah, that's way cool.
We can share back and forth and do this entirely, not entirely with government, but essentially we're taking government software that's being managed and organized by government and helping it make citizens around the world have better services.
That is awesome.
And this has been cool. Super informational. I love it. We like to end or ask kind of this big, broad question to you about the whole big wide world of technology. Where do you see anything cool, new? What do you think is the future of technology in general, not just for your company, but in general, all over the place? Where do you think we're going in this crazy world?
So I'm going to give you two things on this. First of all, I mean, really, ChatGPT, I mean, that was just last week that it came out, and wow, is that ever amazing. The kinds of questions that you can ask it, and the fast answers that it is able to provide, and the level of accuracy that has come with AI saying, write me a policy document on X, Y, and Z. Write that as a play. Write that as a Seinfeld skit. Like the kinds of ways that you can work with AI around both.
We hear the AI word a lot in this question. It's really interesting because it's a fact. It's not going anywhere, and it's only getting better every day. It gets better.
But the other one is actually looking at climate change, which is getting worse every day, and that's something that will affect digital technology as well. We don't think about it often, but the internet is the humanity's biggest machine, and it has a huge impact on climate change. Maybe not as much as everyone driving and flying, but it's huge, and it's growing exponentially. And I think that one of the things that we're going to have to come to terms with in the future of digital IT, if we're going to be here on this planet, is trying to think, how do we be much more intentional about our use of energy, our use of resources, our recycling of our resources? How do we make sure that we're building that into the practices? Like, if you look at the average web page, so Bobby, when we were developing web pages in the 90s, it was a very different thing, right? The average web page was, because you had to hand code it, right? So it was pretty damn small.
HTML, oh yeah.
The average web page now is bigger than the video game Doom when it was first released.
Wow, really?
And it's coding?
No way.
You mean?
Because there's just so many different libraries. Like how much CSS is actually used in those CSS libraries? How much JavaScript is just thrown
in
there because it's like,
Like
there's so much that we're adding, and it has such a huge impact. So I think that the future of technology is going to have to be sustainable because it's so important, but also because it has such a huge impact. So we're going to have to do a lot more with less.
I think that's another place that AI is going to come in and be able to write cleaner code. Don't you think
eventually
we're going to have a lot more cleaner stuff because AI will be able to, we as humans kind of throw in whatever and cut and paste and chop.
Humans
and,
are not very good at deleting. This is a big problem.
Exactly.
We, we can add but not subtract.
Yeah, that's so true.
I think it was today, now that I'm hearing or now that I'm thinking about it, but the government announced some big breakthrough technology in
fusion. Fusion, it's arrived. Yes,
it has.
What? Well,
where do you think that's going in the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, fusion is one of these ongoing technologies where they say, yeah, we're going to have it in 20 years' time. And so what they've announced, as far as I understand it, not being a nuclear expert, is just that they finally have an experiment that has produced more energy than it takes. So it still was like it still probably would be more effective if we'd invested in hamsters and hamster wheel technology. Like, but the potential is so much bigger. Like there's so much opportunity.
You got to start somewhere.
If we can get this right, it'll be huge. Oh, but again, we still have to find ways to reduce our consumption. There still are going to be negative implications with any of these tools, and like we barely know how to deal with the waste of fission, let alone the waste of fusion. So I think we need to focus on reducing our technology and can't wait for a silver bullet to go off and answer all of our problems for us.
I agree.
This has been cool. Thank you, Mike, for being on the show. This has been really, really good. Any last words, Brad? You got?
No,
any,
I mean, I think we covered quite a bit today. So, I have all my questions answered.
Any last words, Mike, for you?
Just words. So one thing that just also in terms of future stuff, seniors are also something that we really need to be thinking about in the future because
downloading their brains.
Well, not downloading their brains.
I'm just kidding. I had to throw that out there.
You look at the baby boomer population. Like they're getting older and older. The number of disabilities that they're going to have are increasing. The how we sort of build interfaces to deal with an aging population is something that's going to be a huge challenge. And again, that's something that is not just here in North America, but it's globally. And how do we try and find ways to have better technology that's able to support an aging population. And we're doing bits of that with CMS.gov and Medicare.gov, but I think that there's a lot more opportunities to try and think about how to support an aging population, which frankly it does involve you and I, Bobby. So, you know, we're not seniors yet, but we're getting there fast.
Yeah, I hope I'm in as good a shape as my 86-year-old mom. She's a rock star.
Exactly.
She don't slow down for nothing. She still drives and... I can't. Yeah, she's on fire. So hopefully I got some good genes. But still, you're right. You're still going to have problems. Still going to have to worry about that stuff. It's good. It's good that we have folks in the world that are actually thinking about that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In case we don't, though, I mean, we always have the show on Amazon called Upload. So I don't know if you guys have seen
that
one.
Yes, that's what I was talking about when I said download the. Yes.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Have you seen that show where they upload everybody into this little world after they die and cut his head off? Oh, my gosh.
I haven't seen that show, but I did read the Neal Stephenson. Neal Stephenson has a fascinating book on this as well. So it's a sequel to Read Me or Ringed. And it's an interesting, I think it's Dodge and Fail, I think is the name of the one that it's worth reading.
Yeah, Ray Kurzweil too. He's always fun for downloading brain stuff. He's
interesting.
He's got some interesting insight. You gotta love. That's why we like the new IT. Who knows what's going to happen here in the next 10 years? Maybe the singularity will happen and the AI will just kill us all. Who knows?
You never know.
Who knows? I'm just saying. Now I'm a positive person. I'm sure it'll help us. Mike, we're going to go down a dark hole. Mike, thank you so much for being on the show. Brad, everybody out there in La La Land, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to The New Eye.